There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So welcome to the Delicious Legacy podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me here.
And for our listeners, you're Ursula Janssen. And tell us a little bit about yourself, and because you are an archaeologist, a culinary historian, and an author. It would be interesting to know a bit more about your background. Which one was first? Which one came first?
The archaeologist came first. I mean, I'm a trained archaeologist. I'm a Near Eastern archaeologist, actually. I have a PhD in Near Eastern archaeology. And I used to work mainly in Syria and in other countries around. And obviously in the last years, because of the political situation and the ongoing wars, this has become increasingly difficult. I am originally from Germany, but I haven't lived in Germany for many, many years. And instead, I've been living a little bit around the world in several countries in the Middle East and in Africa as well. Also because of my husband's job, who is a photojournalist. So we've always tried to combine our jobs as a as an archaeologist and as a photojournalist. And 7 years ago, we were living in Egypt at the time. Things became a little too difficult there, especially for my husband as a journalist.
Yeah.
And so we decided to move to southern Italy, which seems maybe in the beginning an odd choice. But although my husband is Iranian, he has studied in Italy. So that was kind of the second home. We were always already going every summer and so on. And this is the point where I actually tried to seriously work on culinary archaeology or culinary history. Before, I've always loved to cook. I've always done it like this a little bit. But this is when I started to perceive that path a little more serious.
Yeah.
Seriously. And well, yes. And then it came more or less at the same time with writing. But this is another weird story. It happened that I was writing an article for the Italian issue of National Geographic about the history of interreligious cohabitation in Italy, you know, the medieval Sicily, these kind of things. And it turned out that I found the subject so interesting that I wanted to pursue this issue more further. And so I wrote a novel about it, and I found out that I like that. Mm. So since then, I'm also writing novels and cookbooks.
Fantastic. Yeah, so yeah, that's how it came. And tell us a little bit about Trullo and your projects there, and what's... Are you like a B&B with food and people cook or you cook for them?
Yes, exactly. Yes, I have also, I have a small bed and breakfast here in Puglia in southern Italy. And I hold cooking workshops about ancient cuisine. And also I simply cook for people. And yeah, we live the things we are doing. Let's put it like this, because we also grow a lot of the products ourselves that I use. Then we have we make our own wine, we make our own olive oil, all these kind of things.
Oh wow! All the stuff that I think I'm dreaming about doing one day. Yeah,
I can recommend it.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult thing to do, obviously, to grow your own grapes and make your own wine and make your own olive oil. But I guess it's so rewarding, and the taste must be so fresh and different.
Yes, and you know what you're really eating and drinking. It's the good thing about it.
Do you find, I think we're probably diverting a little bit now, but do you find the climate change in southern Italy, in Puglia, a bit more difficult from year to year for things getting drier, or is it okay at the moment?
It's a little difficult to tell. I mean, the last years were a little more wet, but I think the climate is more stable here than it is in Central Europe, for example, because of the seas. We still are, I mean, we are surrounded here by two seas, you know, when Puglia is basically the heel of the boot. So I have two seas. If I go to one side half an hour, I have a sea. If I go half an hour to the other side, I have a sea. It's like a peninsula. And that's why the climate is much more stable than in other places. So we haven't had too much of an effect yet, but I fear it's coming, yeah.
Mm. Okay, well. Thanks for that. I mean, yeah, it's always interesting to see from the people on the ground what they feel when they know about these things, because we live in a city and we don't know. We just read everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's good to gauge different opinions and from the people that actually work with the land. So moving on from here, you always cooked ancient food, right? And over the years.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
So what was the first cuisine or recipes that attracted you? Like, it was ancient classical Rome and Greece, or Mesopotamia, or ancient Egypt? What was, or medieval Europe?
No, being a Near Eastern archaeologist, of course, I also studied cuneiforms.
Mm.
So I actually entered the subject via the Yale culinary tablets.
Ah, okay.
Ancient Mesopotamian food, that is, yes.
Mm. Yeah. I remember I did an episode about Mesopotamian food, and yeah, it's really interesting that we sort of have sort of recipes from, like, you know, 4,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's incredible that something survived from so long ago. And so did you manage to cook some stuff from the Yale tablets?
Yes, I did. And I mean, the point is, the further you go back in time, more and more the recipes become vague, right? Like, as you must know that very well too. Because not only, like with recipes from classical antiquity, that they don't give amounts or cooking times or any of these, but also some of the words are a little unclear. So it's usually clear what category they are in. Like, this is a kind of leek or onion, but what exactly it is unclear, which is on the other hand great for a cook. You can be really creative. You can make it in a way that you would think that it might work well, but of course I think it's impossible to really recreate it 100%, because we don't know so much. But anyways, it makes tasty foods, and it gives us an idea about the concept of cooking, even if not all the ingredients are exactly right. But I think we get a good idea about what it might be.
Yeah, exactly. And the point is, as cooks and as people, we always adapt it to our current tastes.
Of course, right? Exactly.
So we have,
And also,
it's just interesting to see.
Yeah, and also vegetables itself, even if we are using the same vegetable, it has changed so much. Even the same, I also say, for later periods, for ancient Roman cuisine, if they say cabbage, it's not the same cabbages that we are used to today. Things have changed. I remember that eggplants have changed in my own lifetime. They were more bitter when I was a child.
Yeah.
And true. So imagine in 2,000 years what has happened, and then imagine in 4,000 years what has happened. So these kind of leeks and radishes, they are not the same.
Mm, yeah, true. I mean, a lot of things from pictures and from mosaics and so on, we can see them that they look like what they should be, but obviously a lot of them they have changed as well. The taste surely is completely different, and some of them they look actually as you said, the cabbage.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think it was cabbage that looked a bit more like kale.
Yes, exactly. The firm cabbages, they came later. Yeah. Mm.
Do you know when about the period they came roughly, or do you have an idea? It doesn't matter if you don't. Yeah.
I think they were recreated in medieval times, but now also this is of course another 1,000 years to go, so I couldn't pinpoint it more.
it's a vast time if you think about it. I always thought like 500 years ago, it was relatively recent because, reading about history in ancient Greece and Rome, you go back 2,000-3,000 years
ago.
And 500 years ago, it's so recent. But really, in terms of humans and our generations, things change from one generation to another, let alone.
They do. Yeah.
What's that, like 30 generations? Yeah. Mm-hmm. 10 generations, 15 generations? Yeah,
That's a lot.
Completely different. It's a lot, exactly. So you started writing. Obviously, you wrote like a novel. And then from the novel onwards, you went to write some cookbooks, right?
And more novels.
More novels.
And more novels as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we are talking of the last roughly 7 years, so I've had some time to do things.
Yeah.
And living in the countryside gives you peace of mind. That is very nice.
That's so good. Which cookbook came first, the Garum or the Biblica?
Garum came first.
If you want to talk a little bit about
of course. Garum is a cookbook that gives a little bit an overview over recipes throughout history until the Renaissance period. It starts in ancient Mesopotamia.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually skip Greece, I must say. I must admit. No, I go to ancient Rome, which is mainly the recipes of the cookbook of Apicius, which is the biggest collection that we have. It also has some things from Cato the Elder, of course. Then in the Middle Ages, I do both recipes from the Middle East, the medieval Middle East, because I always had this also. I lived in the Middle East. My husband is Iranian, actually, so I have a vast family of in-laws of Iranians, very good cooks also.
Yeah.
And then I go to the European Middle Ages. And the more we move on in time, the more recipes there are, simply. And then the Renaissance, they're mainly specialized on also the Mediterranean region. Not only, but let's say there are a lot that are actually come from Italy in that time. And as I live here, and this is the Mediterranean style of cooking, I've concentrated more on that than, let's say, the British Islands.
Yeah. Did you find a lot of recipes with garum through all this, like Renaissance period or in Middle East and so on?
Yeah, well, in ancient Rome, everything is with garum.
Yeah.
It's quite terrible. I mean, I did all these recipes, obviously, I cooked them all, and at a certain point, my family said, please, stop garum, we can't see that stuff anymore. And I started to replace it with soy sauce, which is actually very nice. So I recommend it even for people for vegetarian recipes, for example, if people don't want to use fish sauce, that they can use soy sauce.
Yeah.
Then in the medieval Middle East,
Yeah.
A type of garum was also used, the fish sauce, but even more common was another sauce. It was called murri. Mm-hmm. And murri is also a fermented sauce made from barley. I have recreated that as well. It is quite salty. Maybe I put a little bit too much salt. But even garum is quite salty. It is. This comes also relatively close to soy sauce. I mean, we have these barley sauces. You get them. In Europe, commercially, there's a very similar, I don't want to say the brand now, that is sold as a soup enhancer, whatever. And this is also made from fermented wheat or barley. So it is pretty close to that.
Yeah.
And
I didn't know about this fermented barley from the Middle East. Yeah, it's interesting. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it, or if you have some information about it?
The murri?
Yeah, the murri. Yeah.
The murri. Yeah, well, the murri process, I made a video about it. I have it on my YouTube channel.
Okay.
It is quite a long process, like it is with all fermentations. And like the barley, you grind it, you soak it, you pack it into fig leaves. The fungi on the fig leaves help the fermentation process. And then later you dry that paste, and then it's quite a laborious process. And exactly. In the end, you have like a dark, salty sauce.
And this is... talking about Middle East in general, you have more specific area that it came from. Where do we find the recipe for it?
Well, most of the recipes, like again with most historical recipes, they come from the courts. So we have them from the centers of power. We have them from Baghdad and we have them from Cairo. Mm-hmm. Which means it is not clear where many of these recipes really originated from, but they were adopted by the courts at that time. For example, in the Baghdad recipes, there is quite a strong Persian influence, for example, that you can see.
Yeah, great, great. And then we go back to like Europe, medieval Europe, and mm-hmm. then Renaissance, but from my understanding, from my reading, is obviously the what we call fish sauce garum was used a lot in the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire, as we properly call it. But then kind of disappeared from the Western cuisine.
It did completely. Well, except for here near Naples, you still have one place where they make it. It's called Collatura di Alici, and it is still made. This is what I use for garum, actually.
Yeah,
and it is. There are a few pasta recipes that use it, but not much. But apart from this, yes, it completely vanished, and the taste also shifted more towards the sweet and sour.
Hmm. Okay.
Huh. You have that a lot in this time. Of course, it also has to do with the idea of the four humors.
Right.
That a balanced meal is a meal. This is also already true for the Romans, but this is then passed on to medieval times, although with shifting tastes. But still, the idea is the same. A meal that incorporates all tastes is a balanced meal, so it's a healthy meal because it keeps the balances within your body. That is the idea behind it. And this is where you have all these meat dishes with honey and vinegar and salt and, well, in Roman times that would have been fish sauce, and then later it's more salt simply.
Yeah, okay. Fantastic. Yeah, exactly. I mean, this combination of sweet and sour and salty and all that it was very prominent back then. Then I suppose disappeared for some period. And then nowadays, obviously, we still we kind of rediscovered it a little bit with the Far East.
Exactly,
haven't we?
Yeah, it is actually great. It is really good, and kids love it a lot as well.
Ah, that's interesting. That's good. Good to know. So you did say about Renaissance period. Can you tell us briefly a couple of things, like recipes with garum or sort of similar stuff from the period? Like if you can mention a couple of things here and there.
Yeah, no, garum we don't have at all anymore. I mean, Renaissance cuisine is not radically different from medieval cuisine, but you have a shift of the focus more towards the quality of the single ingredients, a little more to our modern cuisine, let's say.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the time where the first ingredients from the Americas carefully appeared, but they still were not common at all.
Mm.
You might have them as an exotic oddity, but for example, the tomato, the symbol of Italian cuisine, wasn't really incorporated into Italian cuisine until the 19th century. So after its arrival, it took another 400 years to really get commonly eaten.
Yeah.
What is special about Renaissance dishes? Well, of course, we have to say, like with all historical dishes, of course, what we have are the dishes of the rich and wealthy, like always. Because what farmers ate daily was not deemed worthy to be written down. Although the more you move in time, the more you get also a little more common meals. Let's say the ones of a wealthy merchant in town. These kind of stuff gets written down by the time. What we have in Renaissance, more even than in medieval times, is spices, because the spice trade becomes more and more. Their exotic spices are still hilariously expensive, but little less so than previously. And what we have in these recipes that were actually written down is an incredible abundance of cinnamon. They put cinnamon into everything.
Of course. You have to tell your guests that you are rich enough, you can afford cinnamon.
Exactly. Yeah, that was everything. Really, really important, apparently.
Yeah. Great. And so I want to move maybe perhaps to your other cookbook.
Yeah.
Which is the biblical cookbook. And you have a recipes, you have 40 recipes from I guess, yeah.
Yeah, from the time of the Bible, exactly.
From the time of the Bible, yeah.
I wanted to return a little to the ancient Near East, because that's my original area of study. And we have from, as real recipe collections, we only have those Yale Mesopotamian tablets, which are... Yeah, old Babylonian tablets from southern Mesopotamia, so it's quite limited. And I wanted to do a little more the wider Near East, meaning the Levant, and as the most best-known book of the time and that place is the Bible, I thought it would be a good, let's say, anchor.
Yeah.
To connect with that time, because if I call it antique recipes from the Levant, nobody would know what it is. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I started to, with that idea in mind, I started to actually look into the Bible where there are references to food, and there are quite a lot of references to food. Of course, there are. It's not a recipe book. They are not real recipes, but we get a good idea together with historical accounts, together with the archaeological account, really what people ate. And then with the time of the Bible, the point is I don't mean only the Holy Land, but also Babylonia, Egypt, Persia, Asia Minor, Greece, Rome, the whole because it's quite also the Bible, the time of the Bible is quite a vast time, and yeah. also it covers quite a large area. So with that in mind, I could, with references from the Bible, compile 40 recipes.
Yeah.
And that it what it was it is about, from prehistoric times to classical Rome.
Yeah. Yeah, that as an area, it's a vast area, obviously, all this near Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean.
Yes.
But it has been connected, interconnected, and people traded with each other for many thousand years before Christ. So we have evidence of influences from all these different peoples and tribes and merchants and nations. Yeah, there are elements that they kind of connect one place with another, and you have ingredients that travel far and wide and through time, I believe, as well. So we have an influence, and I believe we can see that influence from back then.
Yes, exactly. Until today. Exactly. Yeah.
So the main ingredients, I guess, will have pomegranates, figs, wine, grapes, olive oil, olives.
Correct.
Right?
Wheat and barley also and then you have the legumes, course. You have chickpeas and lentils mainly.
And these things are staples up to today, basically.
They
and
are.
It's a beautiful thing, I think, to think that you have a connection with the past, but also that we are all very similar. We have this connection between us. We're not so different.
We are not at all. Actually, this is the nice thing about the medieval cuisine. You can see how the cuisine of the Middle East influences Europe.
Mm.
How really dishes come over from via the Mediterranean and they move on north. And you have them really in those recipe collections. They start in the Middle East and then they move on north.
Right. Okay. How did you find that? I mean, through the recipes themselves, like copies?
Yes, through the recipes themselves. It's Luhai. Sometimes they even keep an Arabic name. For example, the Rumania that we have from a Spanish cookbook. Often they come also, of course, via Spain because Andalusia and so on. But then from there they move on north.
Yeah.
Which means pomegranate sauce. Or a very nice example is the sikbaj. In Arabic cookbooks, it means it's a dish with a cooked main ingredient, which is usually fish or meat, served in an acidic vinegar sauce. And our words, ceviche, escabeche, and aspic all derive from that term sikbaj.
Okay.
So even even the terminology has moved on.
What are your favorite ingredients to cook with?
Ooh, that is difficult.
Well, yeah, it is difficult. do you find cooking, enjoying creating stuff with with fruits and vegetables, or with the stew type meats like for lamb or beef?
I'm extremely seasonal, and so is my cuisine. I really want to eat differently in winter. I cook a lot. We have a fireplace. I cook a lot in the fireplace. We have this ceramic vessels that I use traditionally in Puglia to cook in the fireplace, and I make stews all the time with all these, with fava beans and other beans and chickpeas that boil the whole day, that simmer slowly, and then you add a lot of other ingredients. So this is winter cuisine. And then there's summer cuisine that is all about fresh vegetables and salads and these kind of things. And spring, of course, you have all the spring vegetables. Then, of course, being between two seas, we have very good fish here. That's also not bad.
That's excellent as well. Yeah, that's excellent. When do we find the first reference for garum? Do you have an idea about that?
Oh, huh. When is really the first? No, I couldn't say. Especially also as the terminology is a little fishy.
Yeah.
Because of, I mean, you have also the Greek sauces, and then it's not clear what is the difference between garum and liquamen, and that also shifts during time. That apparently in late antiquity, liquamen is certainly not garum anymore. But therefore, I really couldn't pinpoint it, but it's an interesting question. I would guess that the Greek sources are the first, but which one, I don't know.
Yeah, and probably as well as Greeks, probably Carthaginians as well, they were making something similar. So
Yeah.
It's anyone guesses, really. It could be.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, 500-600 BC or something like that, but... Yeah,
it certainly is an old process, but like of written sources, I have no idea.
Yes, exactly. We don't have very specific about the written sources. And I mean, I find it kind of... so obviously, we know fish sauce from Thailand and Vietnam nowadays. Yeah. And a lot of people use it as a... I use it a lot of times for as a replacement for the garum.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's kind of similar... at least the idea behind it, I find it fascinating anyway. That,
apparently the process is very, very similar. It's basically the same. This is also what I recommend in my cookbooks to use if people want to use fish sauce, because that you can get basically anywhere in the world now.
Yeah, yeah, it's very easy to find. Finally, very, very funny, very interesting. I just find it fascinating that such an ingredient can exist.
Yeah. Talking about availability, that is actually a point I find very important, because, I mean, if you think about the world of historical cuisine, there are two fractions, right? There are the fundamentalists, if I may say so, that want to have everything 100% correct and you may not move from there. And then I'm more from the other faction, let's say the realists, because first of all, I think we cannot be 100% accurate. It is simply impossible because, as I said, simply the ingredients have changed. We lack information. And we can try to get as close as possible, but even there, I would try. I mean, what I'm doing both in my videos and in my books is trying to make those recipes accessible for everybody. Trying to use recipes that you can do in a normal household cuisine with ingredients that that are available, that you can find, and also giving options in order to make it more palatable for us. It doesn't make, I think, sense to cook something or to propose to cook something that nobody would like to eat. I mean, I know an extreme example in Switzerland, in the biblical archaeology, there was someone at university who did also these kind of things. But he, for example, he mixed sand into the flour because he said this came from grinding. It was sandy. He put algae into the water to show people how a cistern water would have tasted after it stood a year in the sun and these kind of things. And apart from that, it wasn't nice. I think it is in so far not really correct, because people would have always sought to make food as good as possible.
Yeah, you're right on that.
No, I mean, and this is why I rather opt to alter things a little bit to make them available and palatable for us.
Yeah, yeah, at least palatable. Even most of the time, you want to make them delicious.
Exactly. that's the idea. Yeah. Delicious is the better term, yes.
Yeah, so I understand. I'm with you, I think. I'm completely with that camp of the realists.
Good.
On that respect, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. I was criticized a bit for example, for with the stuffed dormice, for not using dormice.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I can't criticize you there. No. What did you use at the end?
I have two different versions that I made. One in the video, and the other one in the book. Once I used rabbit, which of course is much bigger, but still then you cut it into pieces, or to have these small ones, I simply used slices of meat, and it was more or less more to show the filling, and then you wrap this into the slices of meat, and then you could had like little meat dolma, basically.
Yeah, okay.
but dormice are absolutely impossible.
Fair enough. And I think also the in general, not us, but I think overall we try to think of the past or the people of the past a bit more simple. But in reality, they had ingenious techniques, and they had a lot of complex set of skills that they could, you know, cook or make the food palatable and make it tasty, and the knowledge of using the fire to cook something and the technology they had, they made the best of it, basically. So it was always something we can learn basically from them.
Yes, and importantly, very importantly, they had time. Because a lot of dishes, actually, they require some preparation time. And it didn't have this, now everything has to go fast and you come back from the office and you have to quickly make up something. No, you have to, with many of these recipes, you have to plan ahead.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the things, I suppose it was over the fire. The fire was burning all day. You had it to warm the house. You had it to warm water and all that stuff. So, yeah, it was something that was slow and, long. Of course. It's a different mentality.
It is. Slow food.
Exactly. I'm advocate of slow food, actually. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, I don't have a microwave at home. I don't think I've ever used a microwave. Yeah. Even using the oven, I feel a bit... I'm cheating now. I should really be using the barbecue outside or the fire.
Yes, that's nice.
Yeah.
Bread oven here. It's relatively recent. We finally made a wood oven for bread and pizza and all these kind of stuff.
It's
wonderful. It's really nice. We use that a lot.
How nice. Excellent. Right. I don't know. I mean, I want to ask you something else if I forgot now. But, I mean, is there anything that you would like to...
Okay, where was I? The reason why I'm doing it is that I think that an everyday... occupation like cooking is a great way to hook into history, you know, to get people interested in history. And history, for me, importantly, as an archaeologist especially, is not the history of kings and queens and lords and masters, but the history of common people, everyday life.
Yeah.
And this is what people did every day. People had to eat, they had to cook, they had to plant things, they had to farm. They had to work with whatever was available. And this is also what I want to transmit. And by transmitting different concepts of cooking, which are always connected to, for example, concepts of health, like I was talking about the four humors, for example. Yeah. So these ancient recipes give you an idea about how people lived and what they thought and what they did every day. I find it's a very nice way to do so. And what I'm doing, what I want to do, let's put it like this, is to take those recipes and make them available for people in their daily lives. That you don't need to have a special oven, very special ingredients that you can't find anywhere, no dormice, but really that to have recipes that you can cook in an average kitchen with normal, more or less normal ingredients.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's exactly the knowledge of the everyday people, how they lived and how they, what did they eat, how did they... work and so on, which is something we miss from our history books and
completely kind of
make them very dry, and not many people are interested in actual learning about history, I think, because of that
you only
learn about the kings and queens, numbers, exactly. Absolutely, great, fantastic. So I guess on that note, we can end our discussion for today. It was fantastic talking to you.
It was very nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And if you want to tell to the audience or the people where can they find you, your email address, your website, and how they can visit you and so on.
Yes, I do have a YouTube channel with recipes. It's called Ursula's Historical Recipes.
Brilliant.
I have a website, trulucicerone.com, which is actually the website of my B&B, but also of everything else that I do. So it's a little mixed. You can find everything via there. From there, you can also see my books, etc.
Yeah, great. And obviously, people can contact you via the website.
Yes,
you have
exactly.
the email address.
Yes,
and
exactly.
They can find out if they can stay there and cook and learn, basically.
Exactly. That would, of course, be nice now that we can finally travel again. We are really hoping to host a lot of guests this year again.
Excellent. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
I wish you have many, many people.
Thank you very much. It was very nice
You're
talking
welcome.
To you.
Excellent. Thank you. Have a lovely evening. And
thank you. You too. Okay.
Great. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. Have a lovely evening.
Thank
bye.
You. You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.